to Rochester Today, Southeast Minnesota's source for local conversation about far-ranging issues with appearances from community leaders and guests. You're listening to Rochester's News Talk, 1340 KROC AM and 96.9 FM.
Good morning and welcome to a very special Rochester Today program. I'm Andy Brownell, joined by Kim David, News Director at News Talk 1340 KROC AM and 96.9 FM. And a very special guest, Graham Briggs, Director of Olmsted County Public Health. Thank you so much for being with us, Graham.
Well, thanks for having me, guys. It's good to be on.
You've probably had, what, just nonstop meetings for 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
I will admit, I think the days seem to be blending together. Remembering if it's Tuesday or Wednesday is a little bit of a challenge. I think we've been going nonstop here now for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. And we certainly are learning to deal with what is a very, very fluid situation. Is there any new information today that you could perhaps share with our audience as we head towards the 5 o'clock shutdown of almost all of our bars and restaurants?
Yeah, it does seem like every day there's a new theme or there's a new something that's happening with us. And I'm guessing that's where Olmsted County and Rochester's attention is today, is that we're seeing more and more social distancing and more aggressive approaches at social distancing around the country now. That includes Minnesota. I think one thing that we're looks like getting a little bit ahead of here is that we still have very few cases that we've linked with local transmission in the state. All three of those are in the metro area, but we're moving very rapidly to doing something that other states that have a little bit more transmission are doing, with really putting schools in a situation so that they can plan on how to do e-learning for the near future over these next couple of weeks. And the big thing I think that impacts people on St. Patrick's Day is the governor signed an executive order yesterday that is really going to try to limit people's interaction here on historically a day that a lot of people go out and get dinner or have a drink. We're going to see a big difference here, I think, not just in Rochester or in Minnesota, but as a nation. I think this is going to be a St. Patrick's Day that's a little bit different than we're used to. So that seems to be today's theme, is a lot of restaurants, bars, and gyms, movie theaters, a lot of places where people congregate are going to be closed down here for a little while.
Yeah, and a lot of them have already shut down, too. I mentioned to Andy a while ago, I was at the government center this morning and walked by that office where people renew their driver's licenses. I think the word is getting out, Graham. Those people are definitely spaced out 6 or more feet.
Yeah, that's something we've been talking about at the county for places where we have people queue up, like if you're going to get your driver's license or a passport or something like that, trying to keep people 6 feet apart while they're standing in lines. And so that's something that I think we're really trying to get that message out for people that are going to be out in the community or need to be, trying to keep some distance between each other and think about that as they're interacting with the public or going to pick up their dry cleaning or the grocery store or whatever else here, as we do things that we really need to continue doing, but at the same time really trying to limit situations that we can avoid, like people being shoulder to shoulder in a bar, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Today,
well, the one question I had was, we're getting a lot of input from our audience about public buses and all of these shuttle buses and transportation vans. You look at these buses and you see people in there, and can they physically have people separated 6 feet?
Yeah, I know that's something the governor mentioned yesterday, too. I know we're actively working on, because you've got a little bit of a catch-22 there, where we really don't want to limit people being able to get where they need to go. You know, if somebody's reliant on public transportation to get groceries or get to work, you know, and things like that, you know, we've got a community here that's really driven by keeping people healthy. And so people need to get to their jobs in the emergency room and make sure that we've got medical support here. So we don't want to limit people from being able to travel and do what they need to do. But at the same time, you know, a bus with 60 people on it is potentially something that's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so in situations where we have very few people on a bus, I think it's a good idea for people to distance themselves. But I know that's a situation that is being discussed at the state level on how do you do mass transit and make transportation available for people that really need it, and we need to make that a something that the public can use, but do that in as safe a way as we can. Mm-hmm. At the same time,
is there anything a person who is using that mass transit today can do when they are unable to maintain the 6-foot separation to offer themselves some protection?
I think the biggest thing that people can do right now is if they have a fever, if they've got a cough, if they're starting to get any sort of respiratory symptoms, don't go on that mass transit system. That's the number one thing.
Don't go anywhere.
It's not just protecting yourself, but protecting other people. And that's a big thing we need to think about as a community all together right now, is that people that are sick or feel like they might be getting sick. I know, you know, I'm from Minnesota originally. I grew up here. We are Minnesota tough, stoic people. This is not the time to go to work when you're sick. We want people to stay home and away from other people if they think they're starting to get sick. That's the best thing we can do for people on mass transit, is make sure that we don't get people that could expose others onto those buses.
Hey, Graham, we have new numbers from the state health department in. I think yesterday, Andy, we were at 1,900 tested and 54
close
positive,
to.
Right?
Correct.
And now they're up to 2,336 tests, and they've added 6 more positive, so they're up to 60 now. I don't know if any of those came out of Olmsted County. As far as you know, we're still at 3 here, right?
Yeah, we are looking at some other individuals that are getting tested in the community. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that number changes here in the near future. It's actually, you know, to peek behind the curtains here a little bit, information is changing so rapidly right now. And there are a lot of people getting tested now. I know as of yesterday when the numbers posted to the Minnesota Department of Health website, we were at 3, but I also know we are waiting on results for a number of other individuals, and I wouldn't be surprised if we do have another positive or two that either would get posted today or tomorrow or something like that. I think that's a good piece of information. That's one reason we're nationally seeing the numbers start to spike a little bit, is, you know, I think we've got transmission out there in the community around the country, but now that we turn the lights on it and we're really starting to do testing, it's not surprising that we're starting to find positives. So I wouldn't be surprised if that number goes up in Olmsted by another couple, you know, over the next few days.
Are you at all heartened that with the number of test results that we are now receiving, that the number of positives is still relatively low in comparison to the number of tests that are being administered?
Right. What you're getting at is kind of one of the core things that we look at in the world of epidemiology is what we call percent positive, or when you're looking at how many people are tested and how many are positive, that tells us, too, a little bit about what's going on in the community. And so the fact that we're testing a bunch of people now, you know, it's in the thousands, I think, with the latest numbers that you had. The fact that we aren't seeing a whole bunch of people come up positive tells us that people that have a fever and are a little bit sick and going and getting testing, that's not all COVID-19 that people have. We probably still have some influenza and other routine colds and things like that going around in the community. So that doesn't mean that we're not going to see more of it here, but I think it does give us a little bit better picture as to epidemiologically what really is going on in Minnesota.
So we have some questions coming in from our listeners, and Lori had a question regarding the testing. Was directed not to go to work due to some respiratory illness, and until she was able to be tested for COVID-19, and of course, there are restrictions on who is being tested, and this person fell into that category, did not meet all the criteria. Is there any answer for these folks who need to get back to their jobs or whatever it may be?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. That really falls into what we say all the time about respiratory illness and people that are sick, that whether we're in a pandemic or not, you know, ideally people that have respiratory symptoms like a fever or a cough or something going on, if it's not COVID-19, it is flu or a cold or something else, and those people are potentially infectious with that, even if it's just a routine respiratory illness. And so we always want to recommend that people stay home when they're sick, because these things are transmissible, and there's good evidence to say that by being tough and trying to go in and get some work done, not only is your productivity decreased, you don't feel good, and exposing other people means the whole organization that you're working with, now you've got multiple people that are sick, and productivity goes down for the whole organization. And so trying to be tough and going in and working, you know, when you're sick, actually probably causes more damage than good. And so whether you've been tested for COVID-19 or not, I think there's a standard message that if you're sick, you need to stay home. The testing is really, it's a little bit different than what we're used to in the United States, where I think people are used to going to the doctor and you get a test and that comes back positive or whatever, and you get some antibiotics and you go home. And that's really clinical diagnostic testing. That's allowing the physician that's treating you to know what's going on and then give you the right medicine to make you better. What we're seeing with COVID-19 and why there's some limitations and a little bit different feel to the testing is that it's really surveillance testing. Since there's not an antibiotic or a medicine that we can give you short of just supporting you, you know, especially for the critically ill, it doesn't actually change anything for the doctor to know whether you've got it or not. The recommendation is going to be the same. Stay home, you know, drink fluids, make sure you're getting rest. And if you have difficulty breathing or something like that, come back and we'll reevaluate. But this testing is really going on for public health purposes so that we can see if someone has it, or we see a risk factor that they can, we know about that, so that we can go find out now who is that person exposed and try to interrupt transmission as we try to contain this. And at some point, I wouldn't be surprised, and actually we plan on this in public health, so the public shouldn't be surprised, that at some point we'll be starting to move away from testing as we know it's here, or if we start seeing local transmission here in Olmsted County in places, we might very well start saying, okay, so we don't want people to get tested now. We want you just to stay home, stay away from other people, unless you're having difficulty breathing or you're having chest pain or things that might indicate that you might have a more severe manifestation of the disease. Once we know it's here, it doesn't do us a whole lot of good to keep testing people. And that's where you see this kind of discussion go from containment, where you find every case and every person exposed and make sure that we're stomping on that transmission to try to get rid of it, to this mitigation phase where it's trying to use social distancing and trying to keep people apart from one another so that we know that we're not going to capture or find every case, but if we're doing things as a community all together, we're going to reduce our likelihood of people getting exposed. And so you're starting to see that a little bit now here in Minnesota.
All right. You're listening to Rochester Today on Newstalk 1340, KROC AM at 96.9 FM. I'm Andy Brownell with Kim David, along with Graham Briggs, Director of Olmsted County Public Health. Of course, we're a special edition of the program today, talking about COVID-19 and the coronavirus. Kim, I know you have another question.
Yeah, you were just talking about testing, Graham, and I got a reply from Mayo Clinic, which sent them an inquiry about a second testing site. They are confirming that now, and they are setting it up at the downtown campus, or near the ass part of the downtown campus. So I'm pretty sure it's that site right over here where they are currently parking buses.
Kitty corner from us.
And they are going to release information on that pretty soon.
All right. Okay. Graham, I do have another listener question, and this is regarding food. And ironically, another Lori. We seem to have a lot of Loris in our community.
What's your wife's name?
Lori.
well, hello, Lori.
Yeah, not my Lori. With the takeout still open and the drive-up still available, she had a question. Should we be microwaving the food perhaps when we get it home? to make sure the virus is eradicated, or is that even an effective way to eradicate the virus?
You know, I think it should be okay handling food, and we don't generally see food as a concern. You know, the one, we've got the mechanism here with just the food itself that people are eating. The virus does very well if it finds a way into your nose or your eye. It doesn't do very well in stomach acid, you know, and so eating food isn't really, we wouldn't really consider that a risk. And what we're seeing is the big risk is not as much what we call fomites. There's, you know, some potential there, but I think restaurants and individuals are thinking about that a bit now as they're preparing food and things like that and wearing gloves. And so I wouldn't be as concerned about the food as a little bit of risk, you know, on containers and things like that. But even that, I think, should be minimal. Where we're really seeing risk for transmission is people that are standing within 6 feet of others and getting coughed and sneezed on. You know, one of those things that, you know, I show my kids, and, you know, that is, for those that have a hearty stomach, is if you go out and look on the internet at what actually comes out of your nose when you sneeze or cough, it is,
we don't want it,
remarkable.
All.
yeah, that's what we want to avoid.
Okay, another question from a listener. If somebody were to test positive for COVID-19 in your workplace, will that require the self-quarantine or isolation of everybody in that workplace?
Well, what we look at is people that have been within 6 feet or have been close to a person. So it's not necessarily everybody that's at work, or in some cases, not even everybody who's in the household. You know, if you've got a if you're a parent and you've got a teenager that basically lives down in the basement and you start getting sick and you're upstairs on the third floor and kind of isolate yourself in the bedroom, in some of those situations, we might not even need to consider those people, you know, that are really truly separated at home, potentially contacts. What we want to do, though, is right now, again, we're talking about containment. If we find a case, we want to, you know, what we do in public health is talk to that person, make sure that they've got everything that they need. You know, these are people that are obviously scared. They've got this virus. And so able to talk to them, make sure they're comfortable with the situation. They know who to call. You know, if they start reading something online, or they feel like symptoms are getting worse. At the same time, during that conversation, we really need to go over with them, once they started getting symptoms, where they were and who they were talking to, and if they were at work, what they do for a living, and who they're hanging out with at work or have coffee with, or that sort of thing. And so as those investigations go, if we do find people that we, you know, consider potentially at risk, we notify them. So if you haven't gotten a call from the health department, basically, if you haven't gotten a call from us, you don't need to worry about being exposed. If you have been exposed, you're going to hear from either Olmsted County Public Health or the Minnesota Department of Health, as we're working together to investigate these. During that call, you'd be notified that you've been exposed and what that really means. Because, again, you know, this is something where information is power. You know, people are scared if they think they, you know, might have been exposed to a virus, but hearing that either they weren't, or even if they were, here's what you need to look for, here's how this works, here's the symptoms that people get. You know, 80% of people don't get severe symptoms. You know, some of that information, I think, just helps people, you know, as they're really working through in their mind what it means to either have this or be exposed to it or not.
Okay, as far as the more severe symptoms, we are being told that there's some at-risk people, those who face a significantly higher risk of developing the complications that may require medical intervention, and they're pretty broad descriptions. Mm-hmm. Is there any resources out there for folks who may have, you know, an underlying condition to gain the knowledge of whether their condition might be considered one of those risk factors?
Yeah, I think the more that we learn about this virus, the better we can narrow this sort of stuff down. I think as we're seeing it emerge in Hubei, one of the first pieces of information we got in public health is, first we just heard there's a virus and we heard people were getting it. Then we started hearing that in a small percentage of people that it was fatal. And, you know, as we gained information, we started hearing that people that are in this aging population are potentially more at risk because that's where a lot of the deaths are occurring. And then we started hearing that children actually are getting very mild illness, and so we're not seeing a lot of severe disease or death in young children, which is good to hear. And so every day we get a little bit more information, and so we can say now that for, you know, the numbers are shifting a little bit. I know the MDH is, the Minnesota Department of Health is using the number 70 now for when they're looking at the aging population. I've heard 60 in some other places, but for those that are at accelerated age, that's one of those things just that we want to be aware of. And then beyond that, there's some fairly standard ones that we look at in infectious disease with how your immune system works. So people that are on immunosuppressant drugs, people that have diabetes, that's one of the things that you can see with diabetes is some immune dysfunction associated with that. So I think at this point, just being able to talk to your doctor if you've got a chronic underlying health condition is a good thing. Your doctor's probably keeping an eye on this sort of thing. And for those that want to check, the CDC, just at cdc.gov, is a great resource to keep up on information as it's coming through as far as those that are at higher risk. That's basically what we're going off of is that lead that we're getting from the scientists at the federal level who are reviewing the literature and looking at what's going on in these other places around the world and where they're seeing cases and trying to really figure out, if things like heart disease or lung disease or autoimmune disease puts you at a higher risk. But I think that's changing as we're really learning more about this virus.
On Sunday, we had this big announcement from the governor on shutting down schools, and then Monday came the news about the bars and restaurants. But there's another story Sunday that got out that's kind of overlooked at first, and that was that health officials are finally said, hey, this virus is beginning to transmit now, because up until then, I think it was just people who were in, who would travel to high risk areas or something like that. But that was the first that we knew of that was actually transmitting, correct?
Yeah, are you talking about Minnesota specifically?
Right. Mm-hmm. I think there were three in the metro.
I think that's where we're still at today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the latest I've heard is that in Minnesota, there's three cases now that basically, in the, for those of us that work in this, they, what the Minnesota Department of Health is saying when they say local transmission is that they've talked to these people that have this, that have been confirmed with the virus, and they've gone through the standard things like whether they've traveled to Seattle or Rochelle in New York or these areas where we know that we've got activity going on, and they don't get an easy answer. And so you kind of think of this stuff, an epidemiologist is really a disease detective. So their job when they hear about a case is there's somebody who talks to this person and starts digging through, like, where did this person go before they got sick? And can I pin down that, they were, in Italy in an area where we have infection right when they would have been exposed. So that makes sense. And then we start looking at who they exposed. And so in this particular situation where we talk about local transmission, that investigator has talked to this person and gone over with them, when they started getting sick, where they were in these right time periods so they can look at incubation and see, can I pin this down and figure out what this risk factor is for this person? And if they can't, then we're basically in a situation where we don't know where the person got it. That means they got it locally here somewhere, either at a bar or a grocery store or something like that. So it changes the equation quite a bit for us, knowing that there are people out in the community that we haven't identified that are potentially exposing others. And so it changes the conversation. That's part of the reason you see these considering what we're used to in the United States, what we call fairly drastic measures like closing bars. You know, we don't generally want to do that, and so you're seeing some of those sorts of things because, especially from some of the other areas of the country where they're seeing a spread really erupt very quickly. The more that we can distance people from one another now, knowing that there's a little bit of transmission going on in the Twin Cities, the more likelihood there is that we can really make it difficult for this virus to jump from person to person. Okay. And so having said that, I will say, too, in Rochester and Olmsted County, we don't have any evidence or anything pointing towards local transmission here, but we are looking for it.
Okay, Graham Briggs, Olmsted County Public Health Director on Rochester Today, News Talk 1340, KROC, AM and 96.9 FM. We're receiving a lot of questions concerning the schools closing, and coincidentally, the superintendent of Rochester Public Schools will be joining us in a moment. But to finish out with the public health sector of this, we're taking these steps. First time in my lifetime I've ever seen anything like this. Do we have any idea how long it might take before we get in? Indication of whether we've actually, flattened the curve?
Hit our peak.
Did something that might mm-hmm. be actually working to prevent our health systems from being overwhelmed?
Well, so that's something that everybody knows, this phrase, flatten the curve, now in the country. That was something that only people in graduate school for epidemiology heard, 6 months ago. But it is something that we know very well about, and the whole country now is really talking about. The idea there is to try to limit transmission as best we can so that we don't overwhelm economies and medical systems and things like that, so that we can make sure that we've got enough medical support for people that really need it. And one thing we want to do in public health is be able to understand what's happening in the community so that, number one, we can see, are we seeing cases increase? Are we seeing this curve start to flatten? Are we getting overwhelmed in our emergency rooms? And the more understanding we have that here locally, the better we can understand if our mitigation strategies are working and if we are successfully flattening the curve. I know there's some talk about potentially over the summer the virus going away. So it is common that respiratory viruses seem to fade away a little bit in the summer, but then come back in the winter again. Naturally, what you see with an emerging pathogen is that you see typically a very large first wave of transmission where, 2/3 of the world or something like that gets infected. And then you see subsequent waves of transmission where people that weren't infected the first time around get infected. And after you see a few waves, that's how an emerging cold virus that is, a concern as a pandemic becomes a routine cold virus. And, the cold virus that you caught from your kids last winter that's a coronavirus emerged 500 years ago or 100 years ago and did the same thing, whereas it went around the globe. It was a new virus for people at that point, but we're really the survivors of the last coronavirus that emerged. And so without vaccine, that's the sort of thing that we would see, and that might last for a couple of years. And there's no way really right now to predict if this will go away in the summer. While we hope it might, really what we're trying to do now is flatten that curve until with modern day technology, we've got the ability to understand what's going on in the community and to distance people from one another and to hopefully buy time until we can let the experts get a vaccine put together, make sure that it works and that it's safe, and then move towards mass vaccination. And that's really what interrupts transmission.
In other words, stay tuned.
Stay tuned and stay healthy.
Yep, not the news that people want to hear, but it is something that we're learning as we go.
All right.
And you're so busy, we're done with you for today, Graham. But you know what? I'm sure we are going to have you back, maybe even on a regular basis, because as you said, I think we're just in the very, very initial stages of this outbreak, and who knows where we're going to go.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. I'd be happy to come back anytime if I can help out. You let me know, and we can chat some more.
Very good. Graham Briggs, Director of Olmsted County Public Health, on Rochester Today, News Talk 1340, KROC AM and 96.9 FM. We are going to take a really quick break, and when we get back, the superintendent of the Rochester Public Schools, Michael Munoz, in the studio, along with Rochester Mayor Kim Norton. We can talk a little bit about the businesses in our community and some of the things that our local government officials are trying to do to mitigate what is, is going to be a pretty difficult round for everybody in the community. So we'll be back very shortly. Kim David's here. I'm Andy Brownell on News Talk 1340, KROC AM and 96.9 FM.
Live and local, Rochester Today continues on Rochester's News Talk, 1340 KROC AM and 96.9 FM.
Welcome back. Andy Brownell and Kim David, News Director at News Talk 1340 KROC AM and 96.9 FM. Joined by Rochester Public Schools Superintendent Michael Munoz, as well as Mayor Kim
Another busy, Norton. Busy person.
Everybody in the room, I think, yeah, is busy. Yeah. You busier than I, that's for sure. I know, Superintendent Munoz, you wanted to take a brief moment to give us an update on something that's outside of the coronavirus topic.
Yeah, even though that's kind of been consuming our time here in the last couple of weeks, but really wanted to give everybody a quick update on the referendum. We do have the elementary and middle school design teams have been meeting and working on designing those different schools. I know the pool group has been working as well. And then we just recently, I think it was last week or the week before, released some potential boundaries. Those are still in draft form. We know we do need to do a little bit of tweaking to balance things out a little bit more. But really, we put out boundaries if we end up building the middle school northwest or if we end up building it southwest. And probably the biggest difference between the two boundaries designs were about four schools were affected. And if the middle school ends up going northwest, Bishop would be going to John Adams. If for some reason we end up southwest, Bishop then would go to the new middle school. Falwell Elementary right now, if we end up going to the northwest site, they would go to John Adams Middle School. If we end up building southwest, they would end up in the new middle school. Lincoln, K-8, if they're going to be in different boundaries, but since it's a K-8 school, they're really not going to be impacted as far as K-8 to be more where their high school is going to be impacted. And then the other one would be Gibbs. If we end up building northwest, Gibbs will go to the new middle school. If we end up southwest, they would end up going to John Adams. But other than that, the other schools are really not affected one way or the other. As far as where we're at, we'll know more early April when the city council votes on our annexation application. If that gets denied, then we'll continue pursuing the northwest locations. Right now, we're looking at two different locations. We'll be ready to go with one of those if our annexation gets denied by the city council.
Do we anticipate construction beginning this year?
Well, the goal is to start digging October 2020 is what they'd like to start going. So that's why behind the scenes we're continuing pursuing the northwest locations and hopefully have one of those ready to go if we end up going northwest.
Goodness, you would have had enough meetings on that topic alone without having coronavirus on your horizon.
Yes, we've had a lot of meetings. Yeah. We've been working with city staff for quite some time, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens at the city council meeting in April.
Okay, watch for that. We'll shift gears to I can't imagine the planning process that you're going through right now, but the schools are set to close down tomorrow as ordered by the governor of the state of Minnesota. And there's a ton of questions folks are asking out there, but I'm going to throw it at you, first of all, to explain what's happening behind the scenes.
When did you find out?
Yeah, we received information, it was late Saturday, that we were going to have an 8 a.m. Call. So the cabinet and some other district personnel met at Edison Sunday at 8 a.m. to hear that call. And then I think it was at 10 a.m. when the governor announced. So we found out that information at 8 a.m. on Sunday and started working at that time, spent the entire day at Edison starting to plan for that. And we continue to plan for that. And we're today, probably the one of the biggest challenge for us is that we are responsible for providing child care for emergency workers and trying to connect with all of those different organizations that are in that category is something that we tried to do yesterday. The volume is, we're still not sure how many students we should expect at that time. We do know the preliminary number we received from Mayo was 4,000 employees. So we haven't heard from OMC and the city, police and fire and all those people that we're expected to provide child care for. What we have set up is the process and how it's going to work. We have communicated that to all the different groups that are involved, and we have a small registration form that we're asking parents to fill out, and this way we can get kind of an idea of a head count that we should expect hopefully on Wednesday. We know that number will continue to grow as the week progresses. We also are asking them to bring some type of verification from their employer that they are truly one of these critical emergency workers. And like I said, all of this is online so they can do that. As I heard this morning at 8, we had 100 already signed up, but I'm sure a lot of people didn't get to their email yesterday, so they should have checked it this morning.
Is this through the district website then?
Yes. And the other thing that we are working on is we're responsible for providing child care from 9 a.m. to 3:45, and they'll be at no cost for those emergency workers for that time. We also provide before school and after school child care, but there will be a fee for that, and there's also an opportunity for them to sign up for that if they would like. The other thing I'll say about that is that we'll provide breakfast and lunch for the students while they're in school at that time. Part of the challenge is going to be for us is that now with the new federal regulations of 10 or fewer, we're going to have to spread out throughout the entire building.
That's right.
So we're planning to use our paraprofessionals, our other certified staff that are not teachers, who, you know, teachers are supposed to be working on preparing to provide distance learning. So they'll be doing that. But it's going to be a challenge to spread all these students out amongst the buildings. We plan on providing care at all the elementary sites. And this is for any student who is enrolled in our district, age kindergarten up to age 12. And they will attend the school, their neighborhood school, for this care. The other thing that we are also will be doing is providing transportation. We're going to run our normal elementary routes, picking up students that are part of the emergency workers and, members of our district. So we will pick them up and deliver them to their school. If they're in the walk zone of their elementary, they're expected to walk. We will not be providing transportation for those particular students.
This is quite an amazing undertaking.
In a short amount of time.
Yeah, it's we've been putting in some long hours Sunday and Monday, and continue to meet this morning to work out all the details. So that's kind of what we have planned for the child care. And you know, this first couple of days, we know we'll just have to, as they come in, we'll figure it out. Our hope is that we'll have enough staff to take on that capacity. We're also hoping that we'll have space for some of our staff children, because we know that's a concern for them as well. So we're hoping that we can provide some additional spaces for our staff who will be in the building planning for the distance learning. And then if we're not able to do that, we're going to allow our staff to bring their children with them to school. And hopefully that'll work out. So that's kind of where we're at on the child care piece.
Well, actually, you answered quite a few of our listeners' questions yeah. that I have before me, particularly the one of, the kids are home for what will end up being an extended spring break. But the staff is expected to be there, and obviously they're going to be very busy.
Yeah, we have about 700 paraprofessionals, and some of those we do need to do with to help us with the transportation piece, but we hope we'll have the capacity to take on a lot of child care students and also be able to take on our staff, the students as well. We may look in the second week that if we get to a point where we've heard our teachers are a point where they can work from home, continue to planning, we may do that second week, but right now, our expectation is that they'll report to work starting tomorrow. And work on preparing for the distance learning. And, we're really appreciative that the governor did give us this time to plan for that. I anticipate this is going to be an extended period of time. It's not going to be, well, come 27th, everybody's back and everybody's fine. We really believe that school is going to be closed for an extended period of time and potentially could be closed for the rest of the school year. So we have to be planned and prepared to do that type of work.
Before we move on to the distance learning piece of this, is the district being asked to do anything for the healthcare emergency personnel who work the odd hours, not the daytime hours?
No, the only expectation that came from the governor's orders that we're provide child care during the normal school hours.
Okay.
So that's the 9 to 3:45 is what we're providing. But, you know, we are for pay, just like we currently do with SAC. We have before and after school care, but that will be a charge for that.
For the normal SAC hours as existing.
Well, we be careful. We don't want to call it SAC because SAC, as of today, is gone.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But we will provide extended hours for those emergency workers if needed, and that is from starting at 6:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. or from 3:45 to 6 p.m. So if they have a work shift that goes beyond 3:45, they can stay there till 6 o'clock.
Okay, I'm moving on to the distance learning. Does the district have any, I guess, at this point, idea what this is going to look like for the students and the parents and everybody else?
Not exactly. The good part is this is something that we anticipate was going to happen, and we started having conversations with our teachers about, you know, if we do have to do distance learning, what would it look like at the elementary, middle, and high school level? So we've started those conversations already, and, that's what staff's going to have to be doing Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Really, how's this look? I know the secondary people are looking at trying to make sure that every high school student has some type of device. If they don't have one, the district will provide one for them, and they can use the Google Docs to do their education with students. What it's going to look like at the elementary, we're still working on that.
Stay tuned again.
Yeah, boy. You found out officially Sunday morning, even though I'm sure you had some inkling before that, but it's Tuesday, and you already have the ball rolling, Mike. I mean, you should congratulate that staff, and, you know, they've got a long road ahead of them as well. But as you said, we're hearing that, too, that they don't think this thing is going to be anywhere near settling down until maybe for the next school year. So
yeah.
What about, like, seniors and they want to. I'm sure if they get their credits in and they can graduate and everything, but do you feel confident that they'll have enough learning there to accomplish what they need to?
Yeah, I do. Well, you know, I got asked Sunday during our press conference that, can we provide the type of education you can provide in the classroom? And obviously you can't provide the exact type, but we know that we have amazing teachers in our district, and they're going to provide a quality education for our students. And so we're pretty confident that they're going to do that. And, you know, it's interesting that you brought up graduation, because as I was laying in bed last night trying to sleep, that was one of the things that popped up. Is what are we going to do about graduation? How would we work that out? So that's something that will be on our to-do list. But right now we're working on the online distance learning part. And we're also ready to roll out what we're going to do for meals. We are planning to provide free lunch for anybody from age 0 to 18, very similar to what we've done in the summer. We have locations where we're going to do that: Riverside Elementary, John Adams Middle School, and Mayo High School. So at those three sites, anybody can come from age 0 to 18. You can get free breakfast and lunch at that time. And that's something that we've done during the summer.
And, Mike, are those grab-and-go boxes rather than dine-in?
We
should be clear about that.
Yeah, it's grab-and-go. We'll probably be out, you know, weather permitting, we'll be out in the parking lot handing that out. So the goal is to give students lunch and the next day's breakfast, and they come back and get the same thing each day. So that will start tomorrow already, and then starting Monday, March 23rd, we're going to do a little bit of mobile meals delivery as well.
Okay.
We're going to look at trying to do some of the locations that the city library, mobile library.
Bookmobile.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The bookmobile, and try to do some of those locations. We'll do the same thing. They can come and grab and go meal. But along with that, the Channel 1 is also going to be providing toilet paper and food items as well, so families can not only pick up their lunch and the next day's breakfast, but additional items at those locations.
Can I be clear? Because we've been part of this group. The city has on our, what we were calling our Neighbors to Neighbors network or team. And Channel One wants to be the go-to place for food donations. They're asking that other people don't start their own food drives, that makes it very difficult to coordinate and get the right food to the right families. But what's going to happen is Channel One is going to prepare family boxed meals that can be a week's supply. And so we're going to, I think they're paralleling with the school district sites. People can not only get, the kids can get their daily meals, but the family can get a whole box for a week. And that isn't just for school children. That's for anyone in this community that will have that need. So there's going to be a coordination of efforts. I believe Channel One's drops will only be weekly. At least that's what they're talking about. Could be, we're still working out the details, but they won't be there daily. They'll be there weekly. The schools will be there daily providing real meals to eat right then, as opposed to boxes of meals for a week. There'll be some perishable, I think, perhaps a non-perishable, but also supplies, as the superintendent mentioned. So there's a whole group, Cradle to Career, is going to provide, be the project manager for all this. The school district, of course, will do their part. Channel One will be the food management for, I think that's who you work with too for some of this like the summer program, and many, many others in the nonprofit world are stepping up to help, and so that's still all being worked out.
It's just amazing how much has already been lined up and organized in what, 2-3 days? Just incredible.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, you know, Channel One was saying they would prefer at this point financial donations so they can buy in bulk, because what a dollar buys in bulk, you know, through their sources is so much more than if you or I went to the store and bought a dollar's worth of food. So they're able to get about 4 times the product for that same dollar as we can do at a store. And while we all need to continue personally to shop at those stores.
Well, you know, we've got this March food drive, the annual food share drive going on at the same time.
Yep.
Does that matter?
No, I don't think so. I think they're going to coordinate it, and they're going to need volunteers to do all the boxing, because they want to make sure that they have enough food for a family for a week. And I think, as the superintendent talked about, this is going to be a Monday through Friday effort. We still have to deal with the weekends for those students. And so these boxes are going to be really important for the families to be able to take home to feed the whole family, including that child, over a weekend. And perhaps there'll be some backpacks involved too. We'll see how moving ahead.
All right, you're listening to Rochester Today on News Talk 1340, KROC AM and 96.9 FM. The superintendent, Michael Munoz, from the Rochester Public Schools with us, along with Rochester Mayor Kim Norton. I'm Andy Brownell with Kim David. A reminder as well that you can go to KROCnews.com, and we have an continually updated resource for you on coronavirus information, and a lot of the stuff we're talking about today will be included as the information becomes available.
You start working on this stuff over the weekend, Andy, and it dawned to me, where would we be without the internet? I mean, you and us and the whole world. I mean, it's incredible how much information we're receiving every day in the newsroom from all the government agencies, and then you have all these nonprofits, then you have the private sector. It's just
right.
And my concern is
online.
The internet, can it handle everybody being home?
Right. We're all
or
working
all this
online.
Distance learning using the web.
We will find out.
I probably should have clarified this a little bit earlier. From starting tomorrow until the 26th, there will not be instruction provided. The governor's ordered us that's our time to prepare for distance learning. So when we come back from spring break, if it's extended, that's when our distance learning will kick in.
You Very need good. The time to set up that distance learning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The mayor is here, obviously, and the city council last night took some action dealing with the resources available to the community. And maybe Mayor Norton, maybe you can outline what happened last night and what the council directed.
Certainly, and as I mentioned this morning, there's a couple, there'll be many changes hourly and daily, and, you know, as we move through this, but the Mayo Civic Center is now closed. 125 Live is closing at 1 o'clock today. So I just want to, you know, those are new ads as of today. But last night, the City Council 7-0 voted to move ahead with the resolution had 9 components. So do you want me to highlight what those are? Run through those?
You go right ahead.
Okay,
that's what you're here for.
All right, so the City Council authorized $250,000 in 2020, approved through our contingency funds to support the activities of this neighbor to Neighbor, Helping Neighbor that I just mentioned, team. And that's going to leverage funds from other community partners and public agencies. And that really is this nonprofit network of support that we're talking about. They also authorized up to $100,000 in 2020 to provide from contingency funds to support activities of the local economic stability team, another city group that we've started with the business community to leverage funds from other community partners and public agencies. We're going to work with Ready to prioritize and manage $250,000 in existing economic development revolving loan fund dollars for low interest loans. To impacted businesses and to leverage funds from other community partners and, of course, state and federal government and other public agencies. They directed the administrator to provide monthly reports on the amount of spending, what's being used, and how it's being used. They authorized the administrator or his designee to revise personnel policies on a temporary basis based on organizational needs. So they're trying to provide him the flexibility to deal with things as they come up because we can't keep meeting as things change as rapidly as they are. They authorized the city clerk to allow for up to 4 installment payments for all city-issued business-related licenses. They directed the city administrator to ensure the city is prepared to apply for and receive potential state and federal COVID-19 funding. They authorized the city administrator to temporarily suspend parking restrictions as necessary. We can talk about that a little further if you'd like. And they authorized the city administrator or their designee to temporarily suspend online or by telephone payment convenience fees.
Okay.
So those are the things that we talked about last night. I think the parking is really one of the issues as we have to consider moving forward with potential changes to bus service to accommodate the distancing requirements for public health and safety. People may need, it's kind of counter to
some
what people
may have to start
saying.
Driving cars.
They're
going
to have to
right?
start driving cars, mm-hmm. and they're going to have places to park them because we know we don't have capacity. So this is allowing the city administration around the areas where people will need to park to maybe say, to definitely say we're moving off of those restrictions for now. You know, park where you need to if you are going to your office. And of course, many businesses are telling people, as we just talked about, to work from home. So we're not sure how big the impact will be, but we gave them the flexibility and authority to take care of that.
All right. We only have about 2 minutes left for our program. You mentioned the public transit, Mayor. Do we have any inkling of what might be occurring on that front? We talked to
the governor's supposed to have some direction maybe soon.
Well, the governor has kind of been on the lead, and and so we're waiting to hear officially from the state level. But we've been talking internally too about how do we comply with the feds make changes regularly too, and we're going to have to be nimble and flexible to move around. So I can't give a prediction. People just need to stay tuned and stay safe and stay home if they can.
What about, a lot of businesses are being affected by this decision to shut down restaurants. And not just them, but, the food vendors that supply the food and so on.
Absolutely.
Are you talking to the chamber?
Yes, the chamber's part of that. The second team, the local economy stability team, we're meeting daily online. So we started yesterday.
And are they working on something?
We're all working on how can we leverage funds, how can we support. The state has unemployment insurance available. The feds are talking about creating some funds to keep people stable. My stepson is a server. His income has now stopped. And so he and others like them are going to worry about paying rent at the first of the month. So as well as, other hourly and employee and other people just around the whole state. So it's a scary time for people, but we are putting as many programs and I want to say programs, but funds available to help people get through this.
All right. Thank you, Mary Norton. Thank you, Superintendent.
Yeah, thank
Munoz.
You very much. We'll maybe do this again as more and more things just keep moving along here.
Absolutely.
We are in flux.
We are.
And again, thank you to Graham Briggs from Olmsted County Public Health for joining us earlier in the hour. This has been a special edition of Rochester Today at News Talk 1340, KROC AM and 96.9 FM.